When there's a crisis in the world, people want to put their assets in dollars. Why? Because whether we like to admit it or not, we have the most stable economy and currency in the world. We have the most reliable economy and currency in the world. And in the United States, our economy is growing much faster than just about anywhere else in the world.
Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We are here to befuddle, bemuse, say our names, possibly confuse, hopefully enlighten in the process of confusing, bemuddling, confusing.
Right.
Did exactly. I say that twice? Was I repetitive and redundant?
It could be. But you do such a good job of it.
Thank you. Thank you. See what I did there with that?
Right. Repetitively, redundantly.
Yes. It's quite nice. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We are here to talk about finance, economy stuff, how you should look at the world to make better decisions about your money. But before we begin, we have to tell you all of the things that are required to be told. We must not open. We're going to disclose, which is like not close, but not open. Otherwise, it would just be open. But we're going to disclose.
If we really were professionals, we would record all of these disclosures and then put it on a machine that can speed it up really, really fast where nobody can understand any of them and just play them really quickly in a blurb and then move on.
Well, I mean, that goes with the common opinion of professionalism, which is being able to be completely obtuse and somehow that's professional. Let me get untransparent immediately and that'll be very professional. Mm-hmm. No. So our disclosures are for your benefit and our own. It's kind of good education in the process, which is what we're about. So The Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this radio program. It's also the name of a podcast. It's also, not coincidentally, the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. What does that mean? Well, the firm, who we two bald guys in here happen to be principals at that firm, it gives fiduciary advice to individuals and foundations and trusts and corporations and all that stuff. And fiduciary, what does that mean? In the best interest of the person getting the advice. It is sculpted and tailored advice to people. But we can't do that on the radio because we can't individually sculpt and customize our advice to each of you listening, even though there may only be one of you out there because we don't know which one it is.
We don't know if anybody's listening.
What did you say? I wasn't paying attention.
Got it.
So what that means is that we can't give advice, investment advice on the air, but we can give education on the air, and that's what we intend to do. And as a side note to that, I just dropped the name of a U.S. government organization with some major clout. Did you hear a thump? Yeah, I heard a thump.
Yeah, when you dropped the name.
I dropped the name of the SEC. Because they want us to tell you that we're registered with them. But they also want us to tell you that they don't approve anything that we do. They don't give us any form of pats on the heads or kudos or thumbs up or anything like that because they're a government agency. They didn't tell me to say it the way I say it. I just like saying it this way. Because they tell us that we must say we're registered with the SEC, but the SEC does not approve anything we say, which is really boring. They don't approve anything. Anybody does. They just don't disapprove. That's really what...
Sometimes.
When you file with them, it's not an approval process. It's a, we didn't disapprove you. So it's very much not like these disclosures are not open. They are disclosed. Just got to get that right. That's when we're extra professional. We use a word that no one else uses for the thing that we're doing consistently.
Yes, and we can't give investment advice because this is an educational program. And because it's an educational program, we have to say this, and this is the only really weird disclosure stuff that we use, and I like to use this word. The information presented on this program, in this educational program, has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. I love saying that.
I just give a very clear guarantee that we do not guarantee. I guarantee that we do not guarantee the completeness of unsaid information.
Mm-hmm. Well, the future is always uncertain.
Yes, it's just not what it used to be. All right, so
we don't pay for the radio program.
That's the last one. We don't pay for the radio program, and we don't get paid for the radio program. But we do advertise on the radio
station
for the radio program.
Yes.
Yeah. As well, the studio also advertises on their own station for the radio program. So
you know,
joint advertisement.
We really dwell on these disclosures a lot.
We do. But yeah. I mean, you could say it really fast, but if we're educating, I think it's important to bring these things out here too. When somebody blasts a disclosure at high speed and then just jumps into whatever they're going to say, it almost makes it so the disclosure is invalid. It's like, don't listen to anything we have to say. Please listen to me now. Something along those lines. I can hear Monty Python in there somewhere. Okay. All of our questions this week are interrelated. We've got four questions out there, two from Justin and two from John. Inquisitor John, thank you very much. And I think we can combine these questions, actually. I think it's pretty simple to do it. So Justin's asking, where's the money going? There's a sell-off in stocks. There's a sell-off in bonds. John is saying, what does it mean when people say a strong dollar? The dollar is growing. He's got an article from the Wall Street Journal where it's talking about the value of the dollar is rising in international markets. And then he has another one talking about stable coins, the type of crypto, versus other cryptos, and what is that? And then Justin has a circular misunderstanding of bond prices and yields. Why is it that prices go down when interest rates go up? And they're all the same question. It's just what's going on right now. So if I approach this, you just laid out, people are going to cash right now because they're scared. And I've got stuff from Lipper, the fund rating company, that's showing outflows from both equity and bonds at the same time. Well, that doesn't shock anybody, I'm sure, because the markets are dropping, and that only happens when you sell. If a lot of people are selling, that means money's coming out. Where's it going? Well, it's going into bank assets, as you said, CDs, savings, and we can see that at the Federal Reserve. We see there's about $23 trillion sitting in banks right now, versus about $17.5 trillion pre-pandemic. So we're talking about nearly $6 trillion of new money sitting out there in the banks. People are sending money to the United States from overseas because they're afraid. They get that way in a pandemic. They get that way in a war. They know America is safe. So in essence, they're buying dollars. That causes the stronger to be the dollar to be stronger. It causes
the stronger to be dollar.
Yes, it causes the stronger to be dollar.
Right.
Right. It causes, because more people want to buy dollars, it causes the dollar to buy more elsewhere, but it makes it hard for us to sell things because our prices got higher. So if we're trying to sell to Germany, but our dollar just went up, it means all of our prices are more expensive to them, but it's easier for us to buy. So expect our balance of trade, the deficit, to go up, not necessarily because we're buying more. We will be buying more, but because people will be buying less from us because our prices are higher, because we have a strong dollar. So I'm going to tie that in just a second, and then I'm going to hand this back to you to go back and forth on the interest rate price thing. But I was very intrigued by John's question about the stable coin concept. For those of you who don't follow the crypto world, which is still the vast majority of you, for good reason, there's a kind of, they're calling it a cryptocurrency, but it's not, called stable coins. What is a stable coin? It's not horses, by the way. That would be too cool. No, a stable coin is just pegged to a dollar. So they basically you buy a stable coin and it's $1 for one stable coin. It's not a coin. It's electronic. It has an identifier. It's sitting in this facility server somewhere. And it's got assets to back it up, or at least that's the claim from most people, to say, we're not going to let your stable coin be less than a dollar, and we don't want it to be more than a dollar. We want it locked in as a dollar. So John's question about this is a quote from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. And the headline of the article is "Stablecoins Up for First U.S. Oversight," which it's oversight and overlook sound like they mean the same thing, but they don't. So oversight means that you are looking at them, but overlooking them means you're not. Just get that correct out there. Don't overlook something or you don't see it. But if you oversee it, then yeah, you get what I'm saying there. It's weird. We don't speak a commonly understood language. All right. So what is a stable coin? It's pegged to the dollar. Why is it up for first U.S. oversight? Well, because these things have existed in so many forms throughout history. This is not a new thing. It's just got a new name. In fact, you were just, Elder Baldy, you were just talking about another version of the same thing, a money market fund. But money market funds are regulated because they're called money market funds. But a stable coin is not regulated because it's called a stable coin. It's still, in essence, what's known as private banking. And there are regulations that are very easy to adapt to stable coins to make sure the reserve requirements are met. For those of you that have been listening to us for a long time, you remember us having the same conversation about PayPal. They didn't change the name of a dollar. They didn't say, you give us a dollar and we'll hold a coin in your name. They just still called it a dollar, but it's a form of private banking. What's another one that where they do exactly the same concept? Anytime you go to a casino and you convert your money into credits, that's in essence a stable coin, but it's a regulated stable coin. The gaming commissions of whatever the locale have some federal oversight on that too, to make sure that the private banking aspect of running a casino is done correctly, that they don't break the buck. And that means give you less money than you're owed. In the process, they have to keep reserves on hand. Stablecoins at this point are pretty much regulation free. They may claim to have assets to back it up. They may even be telling the truth, but they may not have the right kind of assets. So we're going to see that regulated. We're also going to see aspects of cryptocurrencies regulated. When cryptocurrencies vote in a universal setting to make changes within the cryptocurrency community, and you get a vote equal to your portion of ownership, that's a shareholder vote. And the SEC can step in and say, hey, now you're for sure a security. So just be aware that every time we have a new type of asset that meets the world, whether that's, you know, we talked about this 2018 and 2019, a lot of the home loans were coming from non-banking institutions, just private wealth firms keep making loans and holding deposits and paying high yield savings. And if you remember that from back when high yield actually was more than a percentage point, a lot of those facilities that were giving that high yield were private banking. And there was a big push to regulate those as well. Because the danger here is, let's say they're doing everything correctly at the stablecoin and you've given them $100. And so with that $100, they went and got some treasury securities from the United States and some short-term debt to some really nice companies out there. So really safe stuff, most people would say. But interest rates are going up, so they may have some internal fluctuation in value. All right, that's no fun. Well, if everybody decides that this kind of stablecoin is no good, some kind of scandal happens, and so they withdraw all of their stablecoins for money or transfer it to a different kind of stablecoin. Well, that company, whatever it is, and sometimes it's not even a company, it's just a person, has to convert all those assets into cash relatively quickly, which looks a lot like a run on the bank. It looks a lot like selling assets at really good companies at a loss, which can cause them to look bad. So it's private banking. And it's really important that we get that done. We talked about this portion of it several months ago about the comptroller of the currency being created by Abraham Lincoln because we had five different currencies in the United States all called dollars, but no linking together of them. A dollar in Chicago was not the same as a dollar in Louisiana. They were different dollars. So the comptroller of the currency was devised to make sure that we had a standard currency. And anytime you have something that says, well, we're pegged to the dollar, but we're not a dollar, it's exactly that era in history. So it's dangerous and needs to be regulated. It's also a good competition for the banks. But it's only good competition when there's a shortage of short-term cash. I said shortage of short. Ha! That's double short. Is that a double negative? I don't know.
Which is a positive.
Right. Well, we were just saying money's flowing out of the stock market and out of the bond market into cash positions right now, which means it's not necessarily a competition that's actually leading to better ethics. It's a competition that may lead to more risk-taking. So this is a good time for those that are in charge of that stuff to be looking into it. Now I'm going to hand it back to you because I spoke in a very boring subject for a very long period of time.
Justin had a fundamental question I think is very important. He was talking about the issue of bond price yields. Why does a bond price go down when the yield goes up and the vice versa? This is the easiest way to understand this. And this is true whether you're talking about money market funds, the dollar, or anything else. And it basically is the law of supply and demand in action. And that is a law that neither Congress nor the president can repeal. That doesn't keep them from trying from time to time, but it works. Think of a bond as $1,000. And I realize that we're talking about $1 in a money market fund and so on, but just bear with me here. Let's just start with something generic. A bond traditionally is $1,000. So let's just say there's a bond out there and the bond is offering 3% at issue, 3% return yield. I used to use 5 and 10% on this example, but that's so people go crazy when I say that now. So let's say the bond is
great.
The bond was issued for, let's make it 30 years at 3%. That means if you buy the bond today when it was issued, and you will get $30 a year interest on your $1,000. Well, that's cool.
Oh, I'm gonna buy a Starbucks coffee with that.
Right. So now but let's say interest rates double to 6%. And the purists who understand this completely, please don't hammer me because I'm going to be slightly off on this. But for general understanding, here's the way it works. That's why I use a 30-year bond. Your 30-year bond that you paid $1,000 for that pays $30 a year is now in competition with a bond that's paying 6% a year, twice what your bond is paying. If somebody buys $500 worth of this new bond, they can get $30 a year. If they pay $1,000 for your bond, they can get $30 a year. Therefore, your bond has just dropped in value to $500 because interest rates doubled.
And once you get closer to maturity, well, that comes back up because they're going to give you $1,000 back at some point, hopefully.
Right, but we're talking about a 30-year bond here. Right. So it's just been issued. It's a 30-year bond. It actually won't go all the way to $500. It'll be up a little higher. But the bottom line to it is the higher the interest rate that's offered on a bond, the higher the yield on a bond, the lower the secondary market price is going to be for it, which is why the bond funds and bond market and things in the bond, if you try to go and sell a bond that you bought last year, virtually or even last several years, I can tell you with almost complete certainty, you know, there's always exceptions to this, you're going to get a lot less than you paid for it. And I've heard bond salesmen say, well, if they sold it to maturity, well, you know, when a person is 70 years old and they buy a 30-year bond, the chances of them holding it to maturity get pretty slim. But whether it's a municipal bond or a government bond or a corporate bond, the bottom line to it is that the price of that bond is based on several things. One is it going to pay me back? Is it sure enough going to be there 30 years from now, if it's a 30-year bond, to pay me back? And what's the credit worthiness of it? The second thing is, what's the interest rate it's paying? And the higher the interest rate a bond pays, the more value the bond has. So, but if interest rates go up, your existing bond with its fixed interest rate value will go down in the secondary market. And if interest rates go down, your bond value will go up. This is a little bit weird to people, frankly, because we have had over 30 years of bull market in bonds as interest rates have been falling across the board for 30 years. Bonds have appreciated in value. You buy one, and let's say you bought a 30-year bond, and 10 years later, you go to sell it. Over the last 30 years, you always got more than you paid for it. So people just got used to the fact that that's the way bonds work. They don't always work that way, because interest rates do go down. And last year, they were down pretty close to zero, year before last particularly. Now they're coming up, and they're likely to come up very fast over the next year to year and a half, particularly. The Federal Reserve is forecast saying, hey, we're going to raise short-term interest rates. That doesn't mean long-term interest rates go up, but you could get an inversion and all kinds of things could happen. But they're also selling off their balance sheet, which means the Federal Reserve is selling bonds into the market. They're selling bonds. They've got bonds that they own, and they're selling them. When they sell the bonds, it converts the bonds into cash. And the more selling pressure there is, this is the law of supply and demand, the more stuff, more bonds there are for sale, the lower the price of bonds are going to go, which raises the interest rates again. And that's what the Federal Reserve is trying to do, is crank interest rates up. Now, let me throw one other little tweak on here. There's a consensus when the Federal Reserve members, board members have been speaking, that they're looking to get short-term interest rates, and we're talking about overnight interest rates, back to neutral. And neutral is somewhere between 2.5 and 2.75% right now.
What is neutral?
That means neutral means it's neither stimulative to the economy, it's neither goosing the economy, making it go faster, nor putting a drag on the economy.
So let me jump in here real quick. And the reason why that would stimulate or drag on the economy is because when you start a business, or when you want to add to your business, or you want to do something new in your business, you usually do it with debt. And it's usually not long-term debt when it's something new that you want to do. You want to get the business started. You want to have a 3 to 5 year loan or less. Well, if banks are charging a higher interest rate on your loan across the board, it's harder to get that loan. It's harder to pay for the loan. That means at very, very low interest rates, 0% financing where available, you can start a business basically with no cost. And if you pay it back in time, there's no cost. You just got money for free. So that's called stimulative. Anybody can start a business if they want to. There's the risk. You got to pay it back. If you lose all the money, you've got trouble. But you don't have this ongoing interest rate cost. We're still stimulating the economy with these low interest rates. If you just look back throughout history, we're still at staggeringly low interest. And it's taking a while for that to rise. But because we've been at low interest for so long, much of the stuff out there is at low interest rates, much of the loans out there, which causes them to be hurt more as interest rates rise. This is something, you know, we talked about this 2 weeks ago and a week ago, that the Fed's going to be raising interest rates half a point. They've been saying it. This week, the market was like, oh, what? They're doing that? What's going on? It's all related. And it all comes into the same headlines that you're seeing everywhere. The Economist had, the Fed that failed. That's the cover of The Economist this week. And it's got Ben Franklin with his hand on his face. The Fed's got to do some things that are unpalatable, or they're considered failures. They've got to raise interest rates. They've got to get us back to a point where we're neutral, where we're not stimulating the economy anymore, because we've got other functions that are causing inflation. Well, I'll hand it back to you to say what would cause the economy to slow down if they go beyond neutral into actually breaking us instead of speeding us up.
Well, we're in a position now where, even based on long-term inflation expectations, if you borrow money, even at the rates that we're seeing commercially in bonds, the bond holder is actually paying the person who's borrowing money because inflation is higher than bond interest rates. That's stimulative. In other words, if I and it is the reason a lot of houses were built and the price, one of the reasons the price of houses went up so fast. If you expect inflation over the long term to run 2 or 3%, and you're able to get a mortgage to buy a house on at 1.5%, which happened for a while, in essence, the value of your loan is dropping faster than the interest rate on the loan. The system is paying you to borrow money. We've talked about the fact that the massive borrowing by the United States government recently at very, very, very low interest rates was so, the interest rates were so low, they were called negative real interest rates. They're below expected inflation. So the people who were borrowing, who were loaning money to the United States government were loaning money to the government and paying the government to borrow their money. And there's some of that that is still going on because interest rates, short-term interest rates particularly, are still below neutral. At neutral, the interest rate you're paying on a loan and expected inflation are about the same. And they're not exactly the same, and we can split hairs over that if you'd like. But the bottom line to it is that's neutral. In other words, if I borrow money and I expect inflation to be such and such down the road, and I'm borrowing money at about the rate of inflation, slightly higher because of the services offered, then that's a neutral position. If short-term interest rates for loans go above expected long-term inflation, that's a negative. That slows things down. That's when we get the inverted yield curve, by the way. It's when short-term rates go above long-term rates. Long-term rates are basically say, what's inflation likely to be over the long term? And if I'm going to loan you the money, I need a little more than that because I could do something else with the money. When interest rates get above expected inflation, they get above neutral, that tends to dampen the economy and tends to send us into a recession, sometimes a mild recession, sometimes a major recession. So it's like Jake said earlier, these things are all tied together. The bond prices and yields move in opposite direction because the greater yield on a bond means that somebody who held a bond with a lower interest rate on it is going to be hurting out there.
Go ahead.
I would like to comment on a couple of John's questions. He talked about the strong dollar and the stable coin. Stable coins are dangerous. Let me explain why they're very dangerous. What are they there for to begin with? Because they're cryptocurrency, they're operating outside of Federal Reserve or in anybody else's current jurisdiction.
And I would have to say, just for a moment, technically speaking, stable coins aren't even cryptocurrency. They just have the label. So go ahead.
But they're a form of cryptocurrency. They're a form of digital currency.
Currency.
Let's like, and as Jake said, they're private banking. Why do people want to use them? Well, because you can do big transactions and not have it reported either to the IRS or to the federal government. And why are they so popular right now? Because, among other things, Russian transfers of money to and from Russia are highly restricted. And so using stable coins, you can get around the system, theoretically. Although I think some people are going to get caught at that. They're very dangerous. And it's a prime methodology for money laundering. It's a prime methodology for tax avoidance, tax evasion, I should say. Okay, now, strong dollar. This is a pretty critical issue. There's some good articles in the Wall Street Journal about this and The Economist and other places. The dollar right now, it takes $1.08 to buy a euro. Very recently, it was $1.25 to buy a euro. I remember when it was $1.50 to buy a euro. The dollar is approaching equivalency with the euro, which indicates that either the euro has fallen or the dollar has risen. In fact, it's both.
Yeah.
Another thing.
There's a war in Europe right now that might have something to do with it.
In the past, the yen, the Japanese currency, the yen, was worth almost precisely a penny for a long, long time. It was 100 yen to the dollar. Easy to figure. It's 127 yen to the dollar right now, which means the dollar has, and so if you look, is the euro fallen or has the dollar risen? The bottom line to it is the dollar has risen dramatically because there's not a war going on in Japan, for example. So Japan's currency appears to be falling if the dollar is the fixed reference point. The dollar is rising for a very good reason. Two very good reasons. Three very good reasons.
Maybe even more. We could keep counting. At least Sesame Street.
When there's a crisis in the world, people want to put their assets in dollars. Why? because whether we like to admit it or not, we have the most stable economy and currency in the world. We have the most reliable economy and currency in the world. And in the United States, our economy is growing much faster than just about anywhere else in the world. And I realize that the official numbers that just came out of China says their economy is growing at 4.8% a year. Woo, congratulations. I don't think it really is. The numbers.
It is not growing at that speed.
The United States economy, when you consider its size, is growing faster than the Chinese economy, even if you use their numbers. So the bottom line to it is the United States economy is growing. The dollar's value is rising because people want to buy dollars because they're concerned about holding anything else. They want security. Another reason that our currency is rising is because interest rates are going up in the United States, the same thing that's causing bonds to fall. Why does that have anything to do with it? If you want to park your money somewhere, and you want the best interest rate you can with security on that money for the next 5 years, let's say, which is, interestingly enough, a very important number. The three, five, and seven-year U.S. Treasury maturities are up there pretty high right now. Why are they high? Because a lot of people are parking their money by buying Treasury securities of that maturity to get them through the crisis. They are completely confident the United States will pay them back. But in order to buy those Treasury securities, they first have to buy dollars. And it's the supply and demand rule again. When people are buying dollars, the price is going up. When the Federal Reserve is shrinking the supply of dollars, which is what raising interest rates and liquidating their balance sheet and everything does, it shrinks the supply of dollars. So you have the supply of dollars falling off, and the demand for dollars going up, that raises the price of the dollar. We have a tremendously strong currency. It's a great time from a strictly financial point of view to take a vacation in Europe, because by the time you get there, it may be $1 per euro, which is the best exchange rate I've ever seen since the euro has existed. On the other hand, if you take a vacation to Europe right now, it might be cut short by a Russian attack, which is another reason the dollar
or
is
a COVID lockdown, or
right,
yeah, there are lots of reasons why the dollar is rising.
And
let's start counting again,
yeah,
because there's a lot of reasons.
But the bottom line to it is the United States government is perceived, and I think correctly, as being the most stable government in the world, backed by the most healthy economy in the world. Where our concern right now is our economy is growing so fast that the Federal Reserve is trying to tamp it down. Let me tell you, the rest of the world's not having that problem at the moment. They're concerned about falling into recession. Europe is concerned about falling into recession. They've got an invasion going on. They're having their oil and gas voluntarily cut off.
Bundesbank just warned that the German economy could drop 5%, as in lost 5% of GDP, if further Russian gas embargoes go through, ones that are already proposed. So they're teetering. The sanctions are hurting them as well as Russia, and oil prices are up and gas prices are up, and they don't produce that stuff in Germany and in the rest of Europe, or just very small amounts.
The third major economic power, there's basically three major economic powers in the world, and the fourth one that's kind of running behind, and Japan is the fourth one running in behind. China is the other one. China is in, and we're running out of time for this hour. We could spend an entire hour on this one. China is in a world of hurt, folks. They have a vaccine, but it doesn't work very well and doesn't work against the new variants of COVID. They have a large section of their population, particularly older people, that are not vaccinated. And they have been relying on a totally unfounded assumption that you can have a virulent pandemic going on around the world and somehow they can just keep the pandemic out of their country. It isn't working. And they've had major cities are shutting down, completely shut down by fiat. And worse, people are, and I know this is sounds a bit extreme, are starving. The government is handing out food to people who are required to stay in their apartments in Shanghai. They just announced to a large section of that food, don't eat it, because apparently it was not stored correctly and people are getting sick from eating it because it's rotten. Yet if they open up and allow people to go out and get food, then the pandemic will run crazy and their hospitals will be filled up and lots of people will die. Therein, they were so proud of the fact that they did such a wonderful job of controlling the pandemic early on, but they never got out of the emergency control mode. The other, and we've said this in the past, we've said it in the newsletter and we've said it personally, the big experiment was going on. The Chinese were handling it one way, we were handling it another. Our chaotic method has resulted in nearly 1 million deaths in the United States, which is a lot considering the size of our country. They're real proud of their low death rate. They're paying the price for it now. So we need to tell you that we are the Personal Wealth Coach.
And if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
Or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com if you're lazy like me. You can contact us through the contact form. You can read our newsletter and sign up for it. You can go back to lots of radio programs into the past. You can see links to podcasts. And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.